From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we get analysis on the riots in Washington, D.C. from a national security expert. Then we'll explore the past year of Wisconsin politics and look at the power struggle between Governor Evers and Republicans in the legislature.
It's hard to imagine if we could have had a more dramatically different year in terms of politics in Wisconsin and more challenging.
Plus, look at some events happening in Milwaukee this month, including one of the nation's oldest celebrations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Since 1984, Milwaukee and Atlanta, Georgia, have been celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And they're the cities that have been celebrating it the longest.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Today, we'll look back at politics in Wisconsin in 2020, then speak with the outgoing director of the Milwaukee Election Commission about his hopes for the future, plus learn about five things to do in Milwaukee this month, including celebrations for MLK Day. We'll begin with what happened in the nation's capital. All eyes were on Washington, D.C. yesterday as a violent pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol building. Lawmakers were forced into hiding and four people died, including a woman shot by Capitol Police. Earlier, the president urged supporters to march to Capitol Hill to protest his election defeat, which he continues to claim, without evidence, was fraudulent. And as the insurrection took hold, he did little to calm the riots. Congress eventually resumed, and overnight, lawmakers confirmed President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Trump has now agreed to a, quote, orderly transition on January 20th. But questions remain about the damage done to the country and if Trump is fit for office. I'm joined by David Preece, the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute. He's a former CIA officer who writes about the presidency and national security. David Preece, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It's good to be with you. I wish it were under different circumstances.
I do as well. You know, last time we had you on, we talked about past contentious elections and the importance of concessions. Now, fast forward to the events of yesterday. To start, what's going on through your mind?
Well, you know what? This morning, I wake up to see that President Trump has issued a statement saying that there will be an orderly transition on January 20th, and that is the ray of hope that is out there. However, it is still surrounded by language about disagreeing with the outcome and insisting the facts bear him out. And even after he saw the carnage yesterday and continued to say he loved his supporters and yes, go home, but we're completely right and we were cheated and this is a fraud and essentially throwing more gasoline on an already raging fire. So for me, I don't know. I have this feeling that we'll get through this. We got through a civil war as a country, and we not only survived, but thrived from that. And I have optimism about that, but what a horrible sight that I never thought I'd have to witness in my lifetime.
Your experience in past administrations and as a security official, I really want to get into your insight here. So, you know, it's not a surprise that this protest occurred. It was announced, you know, that there would be protests during the finalization of votes. But what baffles me was the lack of security at the U.S. Capitol as Congress met in a joint session to carry out their jobs and a mob stormed the building. Now, you worked as a CIA officer and I imagine have some insight at least to the basics of what the Capitol security is like. So how much did this surprise you?
Yeah, I'll hit it from two angles, Audrey. First, at CIA, I analyzed situations like this in the world, in other countries, and never thought I would do so in our own country. It goes back to something that former CIA Director and Defense Secretary Bob Gates said, and I'll paraphrase him. He said that CIA analysts are really good at understanding the politics of every country around the world, except their own. And I think generally that's true because people analyzing the kinds of things that happen in other countries less fortunate than us generally don't pay that much attention to the politics of the United States. And now suddenly that experience is useful. We're looking at insurrections, we're looking at insurgencies, we're looking at cults of personality that lead to violence against government institutions, the kinds of things that we all thought happened elsewhere. So yes, part of it is a lens turning backwards on ourselves from experience earned elsewhere. For the physical security at the Capitol, I'm still getting up to speed on all the various video feeds that are coming out. And what I'm seeing is the fact that Capitol Police Force, which is a relatively large force covering a very small area, has a primary goal of protecting members, also of protecting facilities, but protecting the members. And it looks like when the danger started, they clearly focused on mission number one. And their personnel outside were trying to push back. I've seen some video showing that they were trying to hold the line and were actually overwhelmed. I've seen other video that they simply weren't there, that they were getting walked right by. And that may have been because they were easily outnumbered and knew that any resistance would actually lead to immediate violence. No doubt there will be an after action report. There always is after a situation like this. I think that the inability before the event to anticipate what could happen is a tragic error that led to the loss of life. And there should have been National Guard and other authorities visibly present, even if they were there and off to the side. The one thing that it points out for, obviously, those of us who studied terrorism is how easy it actually was to breach the Capitol. And the lessons for terrorists are horrific. And hopefully any remedial steps they take will be quick and effective before anybody gets the idea that this should be a regular occurrence.
So yesterday afternoon, the National Association of Manufacturers were the first to call upon Vice President Mike Pence to work with the cabinet to enact the 25th Amendment in order to remove the president, you know, quote, to preserve democracy. And here in Wisconsin, Attorney General Josh Call called for the same, and we've seen a few other people do so as well. Would this be the first time it would take the 25th Amendment to get a president out?
Yes, the 25th Amendment actually hasn't been around that long. It's only been around since the late 1960s. So we haven't had as many opportunities to use it as other elements of the Constitution. But it has never been used in the form it's being discussed now. That's because there is a Section 3 of the amendment, which the president can declare himself unable temporarily and assign power to the vice president. And two presidents have done this. Ronald Reagan did it for a surgery, and George W. Bush did it for two surgeries. And the vice president was acting president while they were under anesthesia. Section 4 is the one that we're talking about now. Section 4 is the one by which the president can be removed for disability against his will. And that does require the vice president, and that is essential. It cannot happen without the vice president agreeing to it. It also requires a majority of the executive officers of the executive departments, fancy language, which is usually shorthanded as the cabinet. Once the majority of cabinet officers and the vice president declare that the president is unable to perform the duties of the office, they pass that declaration to the leadership of Congress. And at that moment, the vice president is the acting president. It does not remove the president from power permanently. It simply says he is temporarily unable to exercise the powers and duties of the office. The president can challenge it, and there's a long, elaborate mechanism by which that can be overruled. But essentially, with 13 days left, Mike Pence would be the acting president for the rest of the term. Now, the issue is that what the 25th Amendment was designed for? Because originally, the framers had in mind a situation like a coma or a devastating stroke, or a situation like John Kennedy faced when he was shot. What if that bullet were off by a few inches and instead of killing him, it merely disabled him, but he was not conscious and could not willingly transfer power to the vice president? That's what the 25th Amendment Section 4 is designed for. However, there is a strong case now that the president is unable, for whatever reason, to exercise the powers and duties of the office. He did not do anything in his power to quell the unrest yesterday. In fact, he incited it. But afterwards, he did not go out and try to calm it down. He did not exercise his authority as commander in chief to try to bring powers to bear to stop the unrest. An argument could be made in an extreme circumstance, which this is, that a 25th Amendment Section 4 application is appropriate. The big sticky wicket is the vice president. We've seen no indication from him so far that he would be willing to do this and appear like he is acting against the man that he's been so subservient to for years.
Right. So with Pence being part of the major equation in this case, would the 25th Amendment or impeachment be a more effective tool? And of course, you said there's 13 days left.
Yeah, the real issue here is impeachment and removal is the proper tool. That is, if nothing else, the president demonstrated his fundamental unfitness for office yesterday. Inciting a crowd to attack an element of the U.S. government is manifest unfitness for office. The proper remedy for that is impeachment and removal. And as part of the removal, the Senate can also disqualify the president from holding any future office of the United States. The problem is it takes time. Now, there are elaborate rules that the House and the Senate have set up for how to bring the articles and how to transmit them to the Senate and how to hold the trial. But those are all rules. Those are not constitutional mandates. And the House and Senate can easily and quickly change those rules if need be to have an expedited trial. So it can be done. But to change the rules of the House and Senate and then to go through even an expedited trial that, because of due process and principles of justice, has to allow the president some defense, that will take time, even if only a few days in a very rushed trial. What can the president do in a few days? We've seen what he could do in a few hours. One of the ideas that's out there is, why not do both? why not, in an emergency, use the 25th Amendment to remove the powers and duties from the president temporarily after demonstrating unfitness for office, but also an inability to fulfill his oath and govern, and then buy time for the House and Senate to act in an impeachment and removal process.
So what do you think yesterday's events will do to our country's reputation, not just damage among Americans, but on an international scale?
One of the most jarring things for me to see yesterday were statements from foreign countries that were written, and maybe for all I know, they were copied and pasted from, but they were written like statements that the U.S. government, the State Department in particular, used to issue about political violence in other countries. Countries wishing the American people well and condemning the violence they see in the country and urging us to return to a rule of law. Shaking my head is not enough to say what it did to me to see those. The reputation of the United States certainly has been damaged due to all the violations of norms and traditions and undermining of alliances and friendships in the last few years. But I think most people around the country still get that the United States, despite its flaws, is largely a force for good. And they emulate our system. They emulate our culture in many ways. There's a lot about America that attracts the world. That was not what we saw yesterday. What we saw yesterday was probably the world looking at America saying, and you too, this happens there. And looking for a better day for us, because I think the world does better when America does better. This is a case where America has the ability to use this as a moment to say, what do we want to be? And how do we want the world to see us? And will we live up to the expectations of people around the world who have yearned for America before? I don't want to be the silver lining guy all the time, but I gotta say, it was a very dark day yesterday. But if there's a chance for us to rediscover what it is that makes America great and show that to the world again, we can use this as a wake-up call and get back to where we should be.
David Pries is the Chief Operating Officer of the Lawfare Institute. He's also a writer and speaker on the presidency, national security, and intelligence, who served during the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations as a CIA officer. Coming up in about 25 minutes, Adam Carr will share some community events happening here in Milwaukee, including one of the nation's oldest celebrations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But first, we'll look back at a year of Wisconsin politics that included intense power struggles and partisan infighting. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In many ways, the riot of Trump extremists at the nation's capital yesterday was the culmination of a contentious year in politics. Explosive fights over political power came to define the political landscape of 2020. And often, Wisconsin politicians have been leading the battle. Political science professor Peru Shaw joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to unpack the last year of Wisconsin politics, its impact, and what may be next.
How would you summarize this year in Wisconsin politics?
You know, I think looking back now in January, in a moment where the last few days have been as crazy in terms of national politics as they have been all year, it's hard to imagine if we could have had a more dramatically different year in terms of politics in Wisconsin, and more challenging, both in terms of COVID, in terms of racial unrest, in terms of battles between Governor Evers and the legislature. And I know we're going to talk about 2021, but it doesn't feel like we've turned the corner, at least in terms of kind of a positive or moving forward past some of the roadblocks that we saw in 2020.
In many ways, it does feel like the start of 2021 is really relitigating what happened in 2020. And I think the fear for many of us is that this will be a bit like 2016, where we in some ways continued to relitigate that race for the next 4 years.
Yeah, and I definitely think the last few days have demonstrated that there's intention to do that. And so at the same time, though, I've been, you know, I think really impressed with all of our state leadership across the country in terms of kind of pushing back on that and the role of some in our government to say that, you know, we need to stand behind the democratic processes and institutions we have in place and to validate the election results, validate the outcomes that we have at all levels of government, and start thinking about all the kind of issues in some ways that didn't get addressed here in Wisconsin, for example, as a result of kind of just inaction in 2020 because of this kind of battles over the legitimacy of, I think, of government.
That's been a huge theme, both nationally and locally, the legitimacy of government, the legitimacy of political power, of opposing powers, people on either side of the political spectrum questioning the ability of others to lead. And we saw that play out here in Wisconsin with these legal challenges that to me really embodied this power struggle between the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor. How did we see that play out?
Yeah, you know, I've been looking at kind of, again, thinking back over the last year. And it was in May when the Supreme Court struck down Governor Evers' Safer at Home order. And I think after that, we really saw the legislature really ignoring calls for action on COVID-19, on guns, criminal justice reform, election reform. And so I think one of the ways in which the courts have been, I think, instrumental in this case, I would say, kind of continuing the inability for these sides to come together is to really limit the power of the governor in a way that then puts that office in a position of inability really to move forward on some of these, what I would say many people in Wisconsin are interested in seeing, and that those issues around COVID-19, for example, and the election reform are not necessarily partisan at their core, but we have become very partisan in Wisconsin.
Why have there been so many issues getting legislation passed? It hasn't just been the COVID-19 response. It's been, as you mentioned, the response to racial unrest, questions about police brutality. And it seems like whenever the legislature is tasked with addressing these issues that are important to Wisconsinites, they pass it around for a bit and then they can't get anything written down?
Yeah, I would say that this last year, the power struggle between Evers and the legislature has resulted in the stalemate. And it has meant that very little has happened here in Wisconsin to the detriment of all of us who are, you know, citizens and voters who have been asking for some of these changes to take place. And, you know, I think Evers, because of that, I mean, my take on the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision on that Safer at Home order really, I think, reduced the governor's power. I think we really saw less coming out of that office as a result of that. And, you know, one of the things that we'll be seeing actually in 2021 is more of a clarification of the authority of governors, particularly around public health emergencies. But I think it's those kinds of struggles that then, I think, silence the voice of some, you know, of one office. And then we have a legislature that, you know, isn't necessarily moving forward on those items either.
To turn a corner and in some ways go to a more local and less local story that happened here in Milwaukee, of course, the city was anticipated to have the Democratic National Convention, which in some ways it did, but in a perhaps more realistic way, it didn't. What happened with the DNC?
You know, I think probably for Wisconsin and Milwaukee, this is kind of the most important loss that we had in 2020. I think the ways in which bringing the DNC to Milwaukee would have really boosted many of the kind of political and economic and social vibrancy of the city was really a loss for us. And realizing that we can't have in-person events where we bring in people from all over the world was the right decision. But it led to, I think, this really significant and unfortunate loss for the city. And I think if there's anything that's going to come out of 2020, I think all the ways in which we, you know, had planned for and had relied on that event coming, I think was lost. And it's unclear, you know, when we would ever get another chance like that again.
It was unclear to me if the DNC ultimately had the kind of impact in this way that they wanted it to have, not just, of course, on the city of Milwaukee, because I think we know the answer to that, but more so the political impact they were hoping it would have here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. Did it seem to have an impact on voters?
You know, there's always going to be more cities that don't have a Democratic National Convention than do. And so it's unclear, I think, if, you know, the loss of that had a negative effect on voter turnout here in Wisconsin. You know, I think we can look to say that overall Wisconsin voting was high, but not as high as expected. And so whether or not if we had had the national convention, if that would have been different, I think is hard to say. I do think that one of the lessons learned from 2020 is that a lot of the traditional ways in which we think about getting out the vote and or mobilizing voters through something like a national convention, which is this face-to-face rallies and events that happen and talking to people and mobilizing them, we're going to have to rethink some of those things. Even post this particular phase of COVID, I'm not necessarily sure we're going to go back to those exactly the same kind of events. And so it's hard to know, I think, at this point, how much of that would have an impact. But I think it has required all of us to really rethink what it means to do some of those kind of events and to really touch people in a way that's really different than what we've been used to.
Well, and to your point, this presidential election, in light of the pandemic, in light of the politics at play, was unlike any that have come before it. It really thrust Wisconsin into the spotlight, which I think we expected. But Wisconsin really hasn't gotten out of the spotlight since it all started. Where are we in that fight? Because it's, you know, this is a retrospective. We're looking back at 2020, but it's not over.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that the expectation of Wisconsin being an important state this election was confirmed. And again, very close, I think, 20,000 votes between Biden and Trump. And so an important state going into the future as well. And I think what we've seen over the last, since November, is really just this attempt to kind of continue the narrative of, you know, about recounts, about election fraud, about whether or not there's reason to undermine electoral college votes. So I think that's this narrative of what I was talking about earlier about like delegitimizing this institution of democratic voting in the United States, that I would hope over the next few weeks we're going to get past that. And by January 20th, we'll have, moved forward in terms of thinking about, all right, so all the evidence suggests that that's not what happened in this 2020 election. But whether or not it's going to influence, how people move forward in thinking about the 2022 election, and whether or not, some of those similar kind of concerns around voter fraud and mail-in ballots are going to continue, I think is something that we're going to have to see. I do think a really positive change that came out of 2020 in terms of elections is just the expansion of ways in which people can vote. I mean, I think it's fantastic that we have so much more people who can vote early, can vote absentee, because we know that those are the kinds of things that really can have a huge impact on voter turnout. And I don't think it's for one particular party or for one particular candidate, but it does impact those who have been traditionally marginalized by voting on a single day in November. And so I think if we can continue to kind of to move forward, we have all the infrastructure now to do some of these things, I think that this could be one of the positives that come out of the 2020 election.
Well, and as we look forward to 2021, what are some of the things that we're keeping an eye on, that you're keeping an eye on here in Wisconsin as we put 2020 in the rearview mirror?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right now in January, one of the kind of big things that everybody's thinking about is the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. Who's going to get vaccinated, when, who makes those decisions, how as a state we're going to make those decisions given the inability, as we discussed earlier, of our current leadership to come to agreement on some pretty hard decisions. And so I think that probably will be, I think, at the forefront of most people's minds for the next few months. And then I think the budget. Governor Evers will introduce his budget in February, and then the Republican-owned legislature will pass its own budget in July. And so there's no reason to think that we're not going to have some significant budget concerns given the cost of COVID. And so I think that's going to be another key piece to look at in 2021 and to watch. And then the last, which I think is still unclear when we're going to have a clear understanding when this will happen, is the redrawing of our legislative districts. The 2020 census, I think, has been delayed a number of times for a number of reasons. But I think that could have some really significant impact in a place like Wisconsin, where there has been, I think a long argument about how our current drawing of our legislative districts is not really fair. And, if we were to move into a different direction, it could really significantly change the partisanship of some of the seats in our state legislature.
For sure. Well, Paru, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Paru Shaw is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. In 2020, election officials had to pivot. The pandemic meant more mail-in voting, dealing with a shortage of poll workers, and scrambling for personal protective gear, all while combating misinformation and protecting election security. In Wisconsin, all these issues came to a head in the April primary. The executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, Neil Albrecht, was there for it all. After 15 years, he announced he'd work a supplementary role through the general election and then retire. So WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to him about his experience and takeaways from the job. He starts with the inequities he sees in voting access.
When you look at voting as really the foundation of democracy and often the only opportunity that people have to really participate in democracy and express their voices, when you look at the history of voting, there are communities that really historically have been either disenfranchised or underrepresented in voting. And really what I'm talking about particularly are communities of color, African American and Hispanic Latino voters. And so when you look at some of the issues around racism and racial segregation in the city of Milwaukee, all of those racial disparities bleed through in terms of who has access to voting. And I really felt that my background coming out of the nonprofit sector, for example, I had been chair of the board for the Social Development Foundation, which is the largest anti-poverty organization in the state. I really felt that all of that kind of helped me be prepared for addressing some of these longstanding disparities.
And what were some of the ways you addressed those disparities in the 15 years on the job?
Many things. I'm really actually very proud of the accomplishments of the Election Commission. But for example, at a time when large urban municipalities, I'll use the city of Denver as an example, were moving toward much more cost-efficient voting centers than neighborhood-based polling places, we maintained, the city continued its investment in neighborhood-based voting. And I advocated for that, as did the mayor, to continue to invest those dollars so that most people within the city of Milwaukee could walk to their voting site. The other, I think, really significant investment we made was around voter registration, just recognizing the really significant hardships that many people in the city of Milwaukee are confronted with when it comes to being able to register to vote. We rolled out probably a dozen different strategies, which included the voter registration kiosks in all the Milwaukee Public Library branches to make voter registration as the first step in voting more accessible to residents of the city.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, I have a bunch of questions I want to talk to you about the election that we just most recently had, but one of the things that we're coming off of the heels of is the Trump campaign filing recounts in Dane and Milwaukee counties and then filing lawsuits, post-election lawsuits, based on policies that the Wisconsin Election Commission had in place. What's your take on how these things are going to affect people being able to vote in the city of Milwaukee?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I'll say that I often think of the importance of administering election as being similar to the scales of justice, that it is the job of our society to make sure that we are protecting the integrity of the election, but also that we are providing fair access to voting. And what I have witnessed way before this November presidential election is an imbalance in those scales and a much greater emphasis on this concept of voter fraud and protecting the integrity of the election at the expense of access to voting. But what I think is new with this presidential election is this whole mantra, which is really what it is, this mantra of fraud in elections has over the last decade been used to reshape election law in Wisconsin in a very unfortunate way, but now it's also being used to discredit the election after the election. And that's what's new. But my concern going forward, and specific to Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin, is that the Wisconsin legislature will respond to these unsubstantiated, unproven claims of fraud and roll out new changes to election law that will make it even more difficult for people, particularly people in poverty, to have fair access to voting.
And specifically on the things that the Trump campaign has been raising, like challenges to the indefinitely confined voters, people who are able to say, look, I can't go to the polls. I need to request an absentee ballot and they don't submit a photo ID. And then, you know, ballot certifications that are counting as written ballot applications. Do you think any of those things could change, should change? How would that impact voters in Milwaukee?
I have no question that the Wisconsin legislature will roll out a new definition of who can qualify for an absentee ballot, who actually can certify as being indefinitely confined, which is a very slippery slope. It's very subjective in terms of identifying who can and can't go into a voting site on election day. But I have no question that new restrictive laws will roll out that will very much further reduce access to voting in the city of Milwaukee and impact voter participation. I think it's also, if I could, important to note that the city of Milwaukee is now double digits behind the state average in terms of voter participation. When I started in 2005, the city of Milwaukee was always within a few percentage points of the state average. But as time has passed and changes have occurred that disproportionately impact communities in poverty, African American and Hispanic voters, we have seen that gap widen really significantly. And I think going forward, that gap will continue to grow.
What are some of the things that you think people in Milwaukee can do, officials in Milwaukee can do to increase that access going forward?
Well, so much of how election is administered is dictated by state law or dictated by the Wisconsin Election Commission. And I think it is fair to say that state law is not a friend to voter access right now. But I think on the local level, the city of Milwaukee needs to and will continue to make a significant investment of budgeted dollars in the election commission. But then also the election commission needs to continue to explore every opportunity to assist city residents with navigating the now very complex process of registering to vote and being able to cast a ballot on election day. And I think the city's track record really speaks to that investment. And I'm very confident going forward that that investment will continue.
Well, you made it through 2020. I guess we all made it through 2020. What will you miss about working in the position?
Oh, I'll miss a lot. it was certainly a job like no other. And it at times was exceptionally challenging. But really what I will miss the most, if I have to just single out, one thing is the election workers. I worked with a staff of really incredible people, certainly during the pandemic, but way prior to the pandemic. For all the years that I worked for the Election Commission, for all 15 of those years, I personally trained our chief inspectors. Those are the site supervisors that work at the polling places. And I got all of my inspiration from working with those individuals who perform these complex, exhausting duties every election with an incredible dedication to complying with state law, to all of the checks and balances that are in place, to their personal honesty and integrity, and really do very, very difficult work. So when you are alleging fraud or alleging irregularities, you are pointing your finger at those individuals and making an accusation. And I don't think election workers in Milwaukee, in the state of Wisconsin, in the state of Georgia, or anywhere in this country deserve that after coming out during a pandemic to administer an election. So I will miss working with such an exceptional group of individuals.
Neil Albrecht has been the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission for 15 years. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver as he heads into retirement. Coming up, we'll explore five things to do in Milwaukee this month, including King Day celebrations and yoga. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. January is a great time to commit to New Year's resolutions and immerse yourself in community events. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service has joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the community events happening right here. The list includes a wide array of things to enjoy, both virtually and in person.
So with this idea of a new year, new you, the first event that we're going to talk about is one of those things that I think everybody starts the new year wanting to do, and this is a great opportunity.
For sure. Our first item is yoga with Malkia Stampley Johnson, which is hosted by the Milwaukee Turners. So the Milwaukee Turners has a really deep and long history in Milwaukee. They have been around since 1853. They've gone through all these different eras, and people know them for obviously the Turner Hall on 4th Street or Velar Phillips Avenue. They also do all these kinds of different programmings around social justice and civic engagement. They actually have a new executive director, Emilio De Torre, who used to be at ACLU of Wisconsin, and he started over the summer and has immediately started to activate Milwaukee Turners in all these different ways. So they've been doing blood drives, food drives. They've been supporting groups like Iuta Mutua and Metcalf Park Community Bridges with donation drives. And on Mondays and Wednesdays, I noticed this stream come up in my Facebook feed. They have been doing yoga with Malkia Stampley Johnson, who is a phenomenal, just sort of a TV, film, stage actress. She's a producer. She directs. She does all kinds of things. She's from this phenomenal Milwaukee family of creative luminaries. And Malkia, one of the things she does, she cares a lot about wellness. She's been doing yoga. And I think she's a great teacher. You know, sometimes I can find yoga intimidating personally because I'm expert at it, but it looks like it's a gentle introduction for folks to make sure they're staying healthy. And the tagline they've been using is "A healthy you builds a stronger community," which I love, especially during a pandemic when it's pretty easy not to be healthy.
It's true. We were talking about this a bit before the interview. I happen to know Malkia from my old days at the American Girl store when I used to play a doll way back in the day. It's an odd thing to have on your resume, but Malkia is one of those people who's just a ray of sunshine all the time. So a great way to lighten up the winter.
Yeah, anytime I get to interact with her. Actually, this sort of predicts our next one. I saw her on a King Day celebration a few years ago, and you know, that was a wonderful, profound day of all the different activities I got to engage in. And my conversation with her stood out that day because she was in the middle of a month-long juice fast while we were talking. So, yeah, that actually is a transition then into our next one.
Yeah, so we have a couple events to talk about. King Day celebrations, two different ones.
Yeah, it's worth stating every year that since 1984, Milwaukee and Atlanta, Georgia have been celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And they're the cities that have been celebrating it the longest with continuous programming. Our kind of signature as a city program happens at the Marcus Center. They've been hosting it. And I think that the thing that I associate it with it is the writing, speech, and art contest they do with students in Milwaukee and actually around southeastern Wisconsin. And this year, they have pivoted, like many have, to a virtual format. So it's happening on Sunday, January 17th. At 1 p.m. is when they're doing their virtual event. Their theme this year, so I'm sure that they'll, you know, speeches and writing and performances, they'll have those digitally. Their theme this year is Keep Moving Forward, which was taken from Dr. King's address, Keep Moving the Mountain, from 1960. So I think Keep Moving Forward is a really, especially as we kind of look into 2021 and we're not sure how long the world will be disrupted in the way that it has been, how long that will keep moving. I will say I always look forward to the speeches and the inspiration of the MPS students and school students from around the region. Sometimes it can be easy to forget that there's kids that are they're filled with talent and inspiration, and I love seeing those speeches every year.
With this idea of a call to action, really, the next event is similarly a call to action, but on Inauguration Day.
Absolutely. So the Brown Berets, there's chapters of the Brown Berets around the country. They're a pro-Chicano organization that emerged in the late 60s during the Chicano movement. Milwaukee had a chapter back then. And recently, I personally have just been hearing more from the local chapter of the Brown Berets. For Hispanic Heritage Month, a writer and activist named Juan Miguel Martinez wrote for us kind of his 17-year journey of joining the Brown Berets. So that's at MilwaukeeNNS.org. It was a really great piece and reflection that he wrote. We even had Drea Rodriguez, another Brown Beret, write for us recently about some of her goals as a Brown Beret. And the group is hosting on Inauguration Day, so January 20th, they're hosting a call to action to stop family separation and working on comprehensive immigration reform. They're doing that at a very appropriate location on Cesar Chavez Drive outside of the El Rey, which I assume will be right at the statue of Cesar Chavez, kind of in the shadow of the Si Se Puede mural that's there, done by C.K. Ledesma. So the Brown Berets are a group that I've definitely seen kind of get active in Milwaukee in this last period of time, and they're kind of making their voice be heard on January 20th for Inauguration Day.
That kind of ties into this next item. I should say our conversations are always called five things to do, and sometimes they're events, but sometimes they're things that you can do at home. And this is one of those, a new documentary that's looking at Wisconsin's Latino community.
Absolutely. My colleague, reporter Ana Martinez Ortiz, recently wrote an article on the Latino Wisconsin documentary that came out last year, but is kind of still being distributed. I know that you recently had one of the producers of the film, Georgia Pabst, on your show. She's a fourth generation Mexican-American, and I think many folks know her as a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she spent 30 years. Her and her husband collaborated to really become filmmakers. They went out to seek this story of Latinos in like locally, and they kind of thought of it as a Milwaukee story, but it ended up becoming something that had a statewide scope. So they interviewed some folks locally, some luminaries here, like the artist Reynaldo Hernandez or Tony Baez, Christine Newman Ortiz from Voces de la Frontera. So some local folks are part of it. But what I haven't yet seen it. So you can go to their website. If you look up the Latino Wisconsin documentary, it'll come up. It's not just a Milwaukee story. It looks at how those connections spread out throughout the state. And I think to me, that's a story that, you know, Sergio Cazaz, who is a history professor at Marquette, recently wrote a book named Mexicans in Wisconsin. So I think just looking at our story is not just a Milwaukee story, but how it's connected, specifically that Latino lens. I'm really excited to see this documentary. That is a very worthy use of an evening. And you can just stream the documentary in full online.
Nice. So this last item is, I believe, a project that you're a part of.
It is. So Vel R. Phillips Juvenile Detention Center, it's out kind of on the right in Wauwatosa and by the county grounds. I've had a chance to go and visit there a few times to do some education programming with a colleague of mine. And the young people there, the young men and young women, are really, you know, you could come in with assumptions about how they might be approaching school while they're in the juvenile detention center. And I have, every time I visit there, it's been a handful of times, I'm just blown away by the engagement from the young people in there. And the educators that work with them are really phenomenal. They started a newsletter called Vel's Voice, so after their namesake, Vel Phillips, and it's a monthly newsletter that they just started. I saw the first one and I thought, wow, I mean, one of my hats that I wear at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service is I think about our Community Voices column, and I thought some of this writing that they have could, you know, sit shoulder to shoulder with the other great writing we have from community members. So we worked out, you know, obviously for there's confidentiality involved, so the students don't put their name directly on the writing, but the students' writing is available. And for the first one we published, the first piece from students, they were comparing the NBA bubble to their experience inside of the Vel Phillips Juvenile Detention Center. And I thought it was kind of fascinating to hear them articulate those comparisons between, you know, this thing happening down at Disney World and then this thing happening here in Milwaukee and something they were a part of. So I'm really looking forward to, we're going to be working with them on a monthly basis and publishing some of their work. So you can go to Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, find the piece from Vel's Voice that we published this month and read the whole newsletter. You know, especially during these times of pandemic, like we're kind of divided from each other. And I think some of the populations that are part of our community, we don't think of, it's a perfect time to connect with them. So I think the young men and young women that are at Vel Phillips Juvenile Detention Center, this is a way to hear from them directly and hear their words.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more from them, reading their stories. And I look forward to talking to you next month about the many things to do in Milwaukee.
Absolutely. And Happy New Year to all your listeners. And I look forward to being with you in February.
Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Becca Schimmel join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Angelina Moshe Salazar and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you missed any of the conversations on Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thanks so much for joining us today on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.